We leave Amalfi, December 31, 1943. All good things must come to an end. So saying, I slammed the tailboard up, climbed aboard, and we commenced our journey along the muddy Route 6 back to the farm. Ah, Amalfi, Ravello, what terrible withdrawal symptoms it produced. We arrive back just after dark. The sentry challenges us. Halt! Who goes there? We gave an incredible mixture of replies, from piss off to Hiawatha and Company Limited. I think Edgerton said, W.G. Fields, my dear. White dumps his big pack on the floor, flops onto his bed, lights a fag. Coming back to this fucking place is like being taken to the ballet and then asked to empty the fucking dustbins. Harry starts to sing, Quare Napolitano, non sai di più, the song we had heard in Amalfi. It all had been memorable. January the 1st, Happy New Year, 1944. A muddy field, a rectangular pitch. At each end, goals from a bric-a-brac of telephone poles, logs and branches of trees, freshly painted with whitewash. Around the touchlines are foregathered men of 19 Battery. They have come to see 19 Battery wipe the bloody floor with a team from RHQ. We teach you to live in dry bloody billets, said Dipool as he took the field to captain our team. Great cries of encouragement as against the boos that greeted RHQ. The referee is Sergeant Donaldson, the two linesmen, Jock Hall and Bombardier Marsden. So biased is the referee that just the entry of the RHQ team is greeted with a blast and the whistle and a cry of offside. The game didn't seem to bear much relationship to football. It was rather some foot mud ball. At times, the ball was buried a foot under the surface, and after 10 minutes, both sides looked identical. Thereafter, all players ran around the field identifying themselves by shouting, 19 Battery! Oh, yeah, over here, RHQ! It sounded like a lunatic Eastern Bazaar. All attempts at positional play were abandoned in favour of a mass concentration wherever the ball was. I swear to God, the first goal for 19 Battery was scored by the referee. And when the ball came where the touchline might have been, several spectators joined in the dribbling. The interval was resplendent with two huge containers of tea and a seasonal gift of rum. The spectators went to it first, and the players got bugger all. The game was about to be resumed, but stopped when three 19 Battery players were found hiding among the RHQ team. The game ended in a 2-0 win for us. Our second goal was unique. The RHQ goalie stopped a shot and was standing, holding the ball on the goal line, when Gunnar Devine shoved him in. There was a hell of an argument, but the goal was allowed. Some say only after the referee had promised the goalie 50 lira. Ah, but that night we had news from the front. 18 Battery in a duel had blasted a jerry gun off the face of the earth with an observed direct hit from an AeroP, and 15 Battery had destroyed a very dangerous machine gun pillbox. Oh, Happy New Year! A search for AFN Naples. January the 2nd, stroke 3, 1944. I wanted to get the band a broadcast. With this in mind, I skedaddled to Naples, hitching all the way. After much searching, I finally located the offices of the Allied Forces Network. They were located on the first floor of the San Carlo Opera House. I passed along a corridor of Baroque signs. Capo di Ballet, Maestro di Orchestra, Prima Ballerina, Vietato Ingresso. Finally, a piece of true British enterprise. AFN Liaison Officer, written on a piece of cardboard with a 3-inch nail rammed through it. I knocked politely. The door was opened by a tubby ATS girl who greeted me with, Yes? I'd like to speak to someone about doing a broadcast. Oh, yes? Yes. She stood like a dummy. Well, could you tell me, who to see? Well, there's only Lieutenant Monday. Well, can I see him? Does he know you're coming? No, unless he's got extrasensory perception. I'll tell him you're here. She waddled off to a door directly behind her. Her bottom wobbled as though operated by an invisible hand. She reappeared, blushing, as though she had been interfered with. If this was the case, her molester must have been blind. Lieutenant Monday will see you now. I walked into a room that had obviously once been a broom cupboard. The desk took up most of the room. The walls were barren, save for a nail with a hat on. On the desk was a stub of a pencil, a telephone, and a copy of the Union Jack. Behind it sat a minute, sallow-complexioned man. He was either a dwarf or sitting on a milking stool. If the latter was the case, the pained expression suggested that the stool was upside down. He looked at me as though I'd come from Mars. "Yes, what is it?" he said, shifting his seat. His demeanour gave me the same feeling Edith Cavell got the dawn of her execution. I'm Lance Bomany Milligan, sir, 56 Heavy Regiment. He received this announcement as though it was an eviction notice. Oh yes, he said. Sir, I'd like to get a broadcast for a jazz quartet. An eviction notice, plus seizure of all assets. This was all new to him. By the silly look on his face, anything was new to him. Are you professional musicians? I thought the answer, yes, was a good one. Do you earn your living as a musician? No, sir, I earn it as a Lance Bombardier. I'd better make a note of the band's name, he said. It's, sir, D Battery Dance Band. E Battery and D, sir. What? It's D, sir. D what? D Battery, sir. You were writing E. Oh, he scribbled out the E and wrote D. There, he said, as though he'd climbed Mount Everest. Now, he placed his pencil tidily on the desk. Anything else? Anything else? What was he talking about? Yes, sir. When? Oh, when what? When can we broadcast? Broadcast? Well, we don't know what you sound like, do we? Well, what about an audition? Audition? It was like checkmate. Ah, yes. An audition now. Now when? Anytime. Anytime. When would that be? God, there was only one way he became an officer. He was baptized one. I think my boys could make it the day after tomorrow, sir. The afternoon. Let me check my diary. He opened a drawer, which was empty, and pretended to write something inside. He closed the drawer. Well, that's that, he blinked. I saluted. He didn't. I don't think he knew how to. I walked out past the ATS girl, who was preparing for the next groping session. Outside, I rubbed my hands with glee. I always kept a tin with me. Wait till the lads hear the news. Wow! Now, said Kidgel on hearing the news, what songs will I sing? I'll be a hit on radio, for a start. They can't see what a short ass I am. It took a bloody warning to get us to the air, Fall said. We owe it all to Hitler. Gentlemen, I said, will you all stand for Hitler? Why not? The Germans are toot for him to 10 years. January the 4th, 1944. News that we are about to move somewhere at short notice. This flattened any hopes of the band playing on the AFN network in Naples. Bugger, bugger, bugger. It was a coldish night, so most of us were in bed. Some with bottles of vino, some reading old newspapers, some writing those feverish letters home. I was reading my letters from Betty, Beryl, Lily, Ivy, May, Madge, and for some inexplicable reason, Jim. I will read all the best bits out to the most frustrated gunners. White is sitting up with a Happy New Year chalked on his tin hat. Enter Bombardier Fuller. What's he doing up? He's fully dressed, looking very alert, and bearing down on us. It looks bad. It is bad. He says, listen for your names. He calls out, Nash, Milligan, Deans. He drones on for another 10 more. My God, they found us. We are going to war again. A new position. We are the advance party to dig gun pits, command posts, cookhouses, shithouses, etc., etc. You've got to be packed and ready to leave at 05:30 hours. Christ! Breakfast at 4:30, bloody hell! Why don't they make sleeping a crime in the army and have done with it? I suggest we sleep with our eyes open, I said. Shut up, Milligan, said Fuller. He tucks his papers back into his pocket. He tells us we have to prepare our trucks and load them tonight. We swearingly drag ourselves from our beds. The rain outside is torrential, and into it we go. We had to test the batteries for the wireless set, then test the set, and finally pack all the command post equipment. Who invented bloody artillery boards? What idiot invented drums of cable? What fool made deadweight telephone exchanges that had 20 subscribers and also subscribed to Double Rupture? Like drowned rats, we humped all this stuff into the wireless truck, and you had to pack it very carefully, or you couldn't get in yourself. My companion in the back was to be Gunnar Birch, who had what we call space cancer. With a minimum amount of possessions, he could fill a room. Every flat surface for 100 feet around was covered. Every chair, table, box, floor, shelf, hook, nail, he managed to cover with his mess of possessions. And me, I would make space by carefully packing. Then in would come this lumbering idiot and fill every bit of that. Even then, his pockets bulged with stuff he could not find room for in his kit. Underpants and vests were poking out of his pockets. Vests he could not find space for, he wore. His gas mask was full of socks and handkerchiefs. He was a travelling disaster. Worst of all, he was travelling with me. As fast as I packed something in place, he would throw something on top. By 11 I'd told him, "Look, go away. Lie down. Stay away. Don't come back. I'll do it all." He walked squelching back to his bed. By midnight, I had unpacked the truck and repacked it, making a mental note to get into my seat next morning before he managed to pile his rubbish in. I returned to the shed and was delighted to see that someone had lit a brazier that glowed lovely and red in the dark. "Finished?" "Spike Dean speaking." "Yes, I'm finished," I said, warming myself by the fire. I took off my soaking boots and socks and changed to dry clothes, leaving my wet ones to dry in the heat. Dean's loomed from the dark with a cup of tea. "God bless you, sir," I said, "God bless ye." "Just made it before you came in. There's a whole tin of it still hot over there." "Good luck," I said. "Oh, God bless you, our sport, sir." I wearily slid into bed and sipped the tea. It was quiet now. Better get some sleep. I drained the tea, rolled myself into my blankets, got really comfortable, warm, cozy, drowsy. Had to get up for a slash. As I lay there, the others came dripping in at various intervals. Little Vic Nash is swearing enough for a company of drunken Scots guards. "Fuck 'em," he says. "Fuck, fuck, fuck, fuck 'em." And I think about summed it all up. I fell asleep to his gentle swearing. Fuck, 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 fuck 'em, fuck, 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 fuck 'em. 4:20 a.m. Please God, why didn't you take me in my sleep? Pitch black, cold, and a howling gale. As I dressed, I hear a tree crashing down. Why, oh why didn't it fall on me? Some distant shouts. It all sounds like we're on the moon. Breakfast helped. The duty cook, Ronnie May, served it up like a zombie, then went straight back to bed. At 5:30 sharp, our small convoy moved out. The destination was a place called Loro. In the back of the wireless truck, by the light of an operation lamp, I found the place on the map, a small village on the foothills that ran down to the Garigliano Plains. Across the brown Garigliano River were towering mountains. In these, Jerry was waiting. Amongst them, Jerry, who was going to do for me. Slitheringly, we pressed forward on our muddy, narrow road. First light was eking through overcast skies. The wind was at gale force, coming from the southwest. We could feel the truck take the impact as strong gusts hit us broadside. Behind us was a three-tonner with a digging party. Stark, winter-black trees lined our route. The road was deserted, except for a gradual increase of military traffic going the other way. I hoped they weren't deserting. One never knew in a war. More than once have I seen a squaddy run out of his tent, down a slope to do a pony, and heard anxious voices shouting to him, "Are you retreating?" In this case, he was evacuating. I sat directly in front of the wireless set. I switched on and got early morning music from AFN Naples. I cursed the luck that had spoiled the band's chances of doing a broadcast. However, the news is good. The Russians have advanced across the Polish border and are now 10 miles inside. It seems they might win the war before us. If the Allies know what they are doing, they must occupy as much territory as they can before it's annexed by Russia. Otherwise, the post-war border of Russia will be somewhere near Tunbridge Wells. Every day we don't land in France, it's a bigger headache for us after the war. It's frustrating to know that this war will make Russia a post-war giant and all our military energies will be spent on a peacetime build-up to meet the red threat. It seems that, like Hollywood endings, wars went on forever. As my dear father had once said, the only way to get rid of wars is to have them. Right now, we are having one.
What are we supposed to be doing at this place? Said Bert, who was not the brightest.
We have to prepare gun positions by the 10th. A big do is going in.
What have we got to do?
But you and me?
Yeah.
We do what the rest of them are doing. Digging bloody great holes in the ground for bloody great guns. He didn't answer. He lit another cigarette. Then he spoke.
Why don't the bloody pioneer corps dig our holes?
Because they are all home in bloody Bennywise, that's why. I explained. The pioneer corps only did roads and buildings, not making holes in the ground.
Well, we did the bloody lot. I've dug holes, filled sandbags, chopped trees, put up tents, officers' messes, Kazis, Nissen's huts, the bloody lot.
So what are you complaining about right now? You could be with the poor bloody infantry, being shelled, mortared and machine gunned, and here you are safe and sound in a luxury wireless truck that would be much more luxurious if it weren't for your bloody packing. You loaded this truck like it was a bloody dust cart. No, Birch, you have nothing to grumble about, but everyone has a right to grumble about you. What were you before the war?
Happy, he said, the standard funny answer to that question.
You see, you steaming nit, you can't even think of an original reply. What were you really before the war?
I was a trainee sluice operator at a sewage farm.
And you call that happy? You must be a pervert.
Pervert? What's pervert, he said, his dull eyes blinking.
A pervert, I said, is a trainee sluice operator on a sewage farm. By 11, we arrive at the hill village of Loro. Through it ran the road to the 5th Army front. January the 5th, 1944. The roads in Loro are all the same. Built and paved about 1870, they had remained the same width ever since. A Sherman tank filled the whole road. The only way to let it pass you was to let it run over you. In the main street of Loro was the police station. At the most, it could hold about 10 prisoners in 2 separate cells. Off the central room, which we entered from the road, were 3 other rooms. 2 as bedrooms for policemen on night duty, 1 room for cooking, all on one floor. The morning when we arrived, the place was pretty hairy. In the central room, at a table, sat an intelligence corps corporal, who must have got there by reason of his speaking the language. As we entered, there were angry shouts, babies screaming and women crying. Both cells were crammed with civilians, so much so we named it the Black Hole of Calcutta. They were civilians who had crossed through our lines to avoid the fighting, but all had to be screened in case spies were among them. The corporal was talking to an old Italian man who wore bandaged leggings around his trousers and goatskin shoes. He could have walked out of the 18th century. The smell inside the prison was hell. The prisoners had no facilities and they had to defecate in the cells. Why this situation was allowed to exist can only be put down to the wonderful I'm all right, Jack attitude of the British. We are not cruel, but sometimes we come very close to it. The man in charge was the Commandante of the Carabinieri, a man in his 50s, grey wavy hair, wearing a crumpled grey-blue uniform. He was an out-and-out fascisti, and made it very clear by his surly attitude. He unlocked a room which was to be our billet. It was large enough for 12 to 15 beds. He grunted, "Qui." We all trooped in and chose our positions, mine near the window. I always did this in case of a direct hit blocking the door. But silly, supposing one hit the window. I was immediately made room orderly for the day by me. Vic Nash has started up a cookhouse in one of the adjacent rooms. Alongside an Italian lady cook, one Portenza, a middle-aged lady, all very willing and smiling and amused at seeing a man doing the cooking. She cheerfully helped Vic Nash and was quick to learn the benefits of making tea, and the rewards to be had in the shape of cigarettes and bars of chocolate. She seemed to be eternally on duty, from dawn till 1 in the morning. When I think of some of those soppy females of today, who get a charlady to clean their flat of 3 rooms while they phone their friends and eat chocolates, I realise a change in the quality of ladies' working lives. Howling gales continued, blotting out any sounds of gunfire. It was a gorgeous, easy day. I was able to renovate my kit, sewing up socks, putting buttons on my trousers that had been held up with knotted string and signal wire. Any message for my trousers today? At 11 o'clock, Portenza brought me a mug of tea. I lay back on my bed, sipping it, and reading from an anthology of English poets I had bought in a shop at Castellamare. I read the love sonnets of Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, who apparently imitated Petrarch. I love trouble imitating Al Jolson. Somewhere outside, the gunners were digging in heavy mud and a howling gale. When they returned that evening, soaked, muddy, tired, I just didn't have the heart to tell them I'd been reading, "With sweet season that bud and bloom forth brings, with green hat clad the hill and yeek the vale." Soon the room filled with cigarette smoke, swearing, moaning, and an occasional snatch of song. After a hot meal, there was aught to do but get into bed. A last gesture of sociability, I went outside to the wireless truck, listened to the BBC News, jotted down the main details, and from my bed read it out to the lads. The best-received news was the unstoppable grinding advance of the Russian army, who were well inside the Polish border, the announcement of which brought a small, tired cheer. Birch was sitting up in his bed, his arms folded, and an unlit cigarette embedded in his face.
"I'm too bloody tired to smoke," he said.
"Well, try steaming," I said. "It's easier."
Bombardier Harry Homer chips in. "It's all right with Sam Milligan sitting in her ass all day playing that bugle."
"What? I swear on the Pope's legs, I have not touched the bugle all day." I slept very soundly that night. Isn't that Betty Grable I can see? Thursday, January the 6th, 1944. On the job at 8:15. Bitter cold. Through the bushes masking our position, we can see the snow on the hills across the Garigliano. We are supposed to dig a command post, but no. We find a super cave right near the gun positions. So, instead, now we have to dig a cookhouse. This took most of the day. We dug into a bank under the supervision of Vic Nash. There is nothing so invigorating as the next old Kent Road pastry cook telling you how to dig a hole. Hands and feet are freezing. The only way to get them warm is to dig. By 5 o'clock, it was too dark to see. We returned to the billet and luxuriated in the warmth inside, provided by an old Italian device. A large stone, the size of a millstone, with a countersunk hole in the middle, filled with charcoal that burnt brightly with the minimum of smoke. It was all very quiet here, but at night we could hear how close our infantry were by the exchange of machine gun fire, just over the brow of a hillock behind us. We could also hear the grumble of vehicles bringing up supplies for the new build-up, and a sound that always made me feel ill. Infantrymen coming up the line, the unending trudge of what sounded like hollow boots, and the occasional clank or clink of some metal equipment, and most distinctive, that ring of an empty metal tea mug. I used to wonder how in God's name the High Command could keep the movement of 250,000 men secret. I always had the feeling that Hitler knew exactly where I was all the time. On this, the coldest day of the year, we hear that bitter fighting is going on for Vittori. We are now only 5 miles from Cassino, around which would rage the worst fighting of World War II. The days that follows were all the same. Digging. To speed up the process, more gunners arrive to dig, wait for it, at night. Mail is slow coming up here, owing to traffic congestion and the one-way road system. Friday, January the 7th, 1944. What's this mess approaching at dawn? It's a fully shagged-out gunner, answering to the name of Edgington. Ah! He collapses into our billet. What a bloody caper! Up at 4 a bleeding clock, half a mug of cold tea, a spoonful of egg powder, and now this bleeding crap hole. He drops his kit. "Welcome home, young mass, I say. The plantation ain't been the same without you." Oh, he groaned as he fossicked in his pockets for fags. Seeing him nigh to death, my heart was sore afraid, so I scrounged him an extra mug of tea, then sat him down on his big pack. "Now, tell Mummy, was there a rude boy at school today?" "I refuse to be cheered up," he said. "There'll be no smiling eye till about midday." "No? Let me help you keep that way. There's bloody great holes in the ground to be dug, and you have to dig him in the cripple position, otherwise Jerry can see you. He is soon with the shovel, and the wind whistleth through the seams in his underpants, and he liketh it not. A young Italian boy from the village came up and did some digging for us. As a mark of appreciation, we gave him a few V cigarettes that would stunt his growth. We get a visit from the village barber in an immaculate white jacket. He cut the hair of the entire mob. He's very thorough, snipping hairs in the ears and nose. He went away, his pockets bulging. "It's mad," said Edgington, "paying for something you don't want." Captain Sullivan comes up to poke around. "Yes," he said, and left. Was it worth the journey? January 8, 1944, my diary. Weather warmer, digging. January 9, 1944, my diary, digging and swearing. January 10, 1944, my diary, digging and swearing. January 11, 1944, my diary, digging finished, swearing continues. At last we could relax, but still all movement had to be minimal and carried out under cover. Nash used to hold a piece of cardboard over his head. He was desperate for an officer to ask why, but it never came to pass. One fine morning he says, "I might have a look at Jerry Lyons. It's a nice clear day. The view ought to be good." And he was right. The view was so good, he got a Jerry bullet over his head and a terrible telling off from Sergeant Jock Wilson. "You want to give away our position, you stupid little cockney, can't you?" We had done all the digging and were now to excavate our own G-truck billet. Down a small bank, we find an ideal spot and start to dig. We make it almost a room-sized excavation. We roof it with corrugated iron, prop it up with poles, some canvas to waterproof it, a camouflage net on top, along with some dressings of bushes and branches. With loving care, I tunnel out a large chimney and had a fire going to dry out the interior. What I needed for my bed was a good piece of wood. Now, Gunner Nash had mentioned a ruined catacomb in a church across the road.
"Yes, there's a ruined catacomb in the church across the road. You can see them to the floor."
Yes, indeed. Nash saw Milligan disappear down the hole, and soon hurling upwards were numerous bones, skulls, rocks, etc., as I searched for a coffin lid. Eureka! I got three, and soon I was lying on one in grand style. The others I gave to Deans and one to the telephone exchange for the duty signalers to lean against. January 12, 1944. Troops in front of us are our old friends, the Berkshires, and a new mob, the London Scottish. "Heard Itmar on the radio this evening. Corny bastards. Heard Henry Hall and his band. Corny bastards. Have laid in a good supply of firewood. Made two oil lamps, now in niches inside our dugout. Knocked off drum of Dervoil from Park Lorry. Swapped soapy cigarettes with Italians in exchange for eggs. Had a marvellous evening. Boiled the eggs and floated them in our beef stew and potatoes. Ate it sitting on my coffin lid. I gazed long into the fire and listened to Deans holding forth about the war. It must end soon, he says. It must end soon. Why, I said, because I wanted to. If wanting to is going to end it, I wanted it to end the day before I bloody join. I'll tell you when it's going to end, said Files in between mouthfuls. When we flatten every German city and every German, that's the way it will end. I think he's going to lose, but we can't afford to let up here. He knows he's going to go on retreating, but the bastard only wants revenge in the form of our blood. The blokes running their war would rather burn Germany to the ground than surrender. They'll only surrender when they have to, and that goes for the little yellow fucking creeps of Japs. Oh, Christ, said Deans, I've forgotten about them. It'll be just our bloody luck. When we finish off Jerry, we'll be shipped off to the bloody jungles. It's never going to end. Down on the plain, there was a burst of machine gun fire. Trained ears recognized it as Jerry's. There was a response from Tommy guns. Two patrols had clashed. Life and death. More shooting. And I slide another spoonful of dinner in. I really can't get it all together. Us dining and them dying. A head pokes to the blackout. It's gambling mad Bombardier Marzen. Pontoon, piss off, we said. The head disappeared. We could hear him visiting all the dugouts around. How come he always seems to win, I said. Never mind that, said Files. How come we always seem to bloody lose?